This is In Deep. I'm Angie Cuero. We're spending this hour with you in the workplace, racing around filling warehouse orders and damaging your body with Mac McClelland of Mother Jones Magazine, facing your potential new boss who wants your Facebook password with attorney Mike Godwin, and finally, how to organize a union on the job, a 1-2-3 guide. In Deep, on the job this hour. Stick around. And as the clouds part and the sun streams down on the brilliant hillside, a large cream pie comes out of the clouds and smacks onto the ground. That would be the entry of our own Gotta Laugh, our demented sidekick, Buttercup, with her own particular take on the important news du jour. Hi, Laffy.
God, I'm sorry. I was nearly late today. I was busy pointing and laughing at Karl Rove trying to grow a penis.
That's a full-time job.
It is. He still hasn't succeeded at that. It's terrible. But have you heard the latest about what he has said? He did a little op-ed in the Wall Street Journal.
I'm mercifully ignorant, but do fill me in.
Oh, my God, this man. Did I call him a man? I'm sorry.
A man-shaped object.
Yes. Here's what he wrote. He said, as for the killing of Osama bin Laden, Mr. Obama did what virtually any commander-in-chief would have done in the same situation. Even President Bill Clinton says in the film, and he's talking about The Road We've Traveled, the 17-minute documentary that President Obama put out. Even President Bill Clinton says in the film, that's the call I would have made. For this to be portrayed as the epic achievement of the first term tells you how bare the White House cupboards are.
Okay, oh, please.
There's a little problem with what he said, though.
Yeah.
And that is, he left out a whole bunch of context. He left out the actual quote, which is from Bill Clinton. He took the harder and more honorable path. When I saw what had happened, I thought to myself, I hope that's the call I would have made. And so he left out the word hope, which I find ironic.
Yes.
And then he did an update, because I guess they got so much flack for that in the Wall Street Journal, because, you know, the standards of journalism would be, you know, wouldn't you think, to correct it. So here, their correction was adding just the sentence, even President Bill Clinton says in the film, I hope that's the call I would have made, to which Greg Sargent of the Washington Post said, as you can see, Clinton's quote no longer supports the point Rove was making.
Go, Greg.
And the current version is still truncated, and as a result, still misses the spirit of his remark, which is completely at odds with Rove's argument. So he blew it, and they blew it, and everybody blew it, no matter which way you look at it.
And can I just point out that if George Bush had accomplished this, I mean, this would have been the greatest accomplishment in the history of the presidential United States.
His codpiece would have been at attention.
So we're going to get off this topic before we both get ourselves in trouble with the FCC. So let us move on to your next topic.
Yes, let's talk about the Arizona representative named Terry Proud. And that's an ironic name when you hear what she wants to do. I'm just going to read her quote to you.
Okay.
Personally, I'd like to make a law that mandates a woman watch an abortion being performed prior to having a surgical procedure. If it's not a life, it shouldn't matter. If it doesn't harm a woman, then she shouldn't care. And don't we want more transparency and education in the medical profession anyway? We demand it everywhere else. Until the dead child can tell me that he does not feel any pain, I have no intentions of clearing the conscience of the living. I will be voting yes.
Oh, God. It's funny because I looked it up on your site as you were describing it, and you went on your site exactly where I was going to go, which is to say, look, I had a tonsillectomy. I wouldn't have had it if I had to look at it first. If I had to see human meat being cut into, tonsillectomy, appendectomy, and you went into the same things.
Like, vasectomy. Let's, like, the men do it too. But here's the thing. There are a couple of things. First of all, think about it. Let's just say we agree with everything she's saying, which we don't. But let's just say we do. Then she has to somehow, the person who's getting the abortion has to find an opportunity to view an abortion being done, which means going out of state or going across the state or going to another city or whatever it happens to be, or being, you know, even in her own city, scheduling, where they have to schedule an abortion, and then they have to allow her to observe. And then, as Keith Olbermann pointed out, the person getting the abortion, what about her privacy rights? Someone's looking at her getting an abortion.
Oh, honey, she's a woman. She doesn't need privacy.
Oh, I forgot.
You're so old-fashioned. Let's get off of this before I get mad. What else you got?
Here in Los Angeles, we have a wonderful, or we did have a wonderful progressive radio station, K-Talk. And I do love it. I loved it even more when they had more progressive hosts on, but little by little they're chipping away at the hosts, and on the weekends they're gone. They're now long infomercials about holistic medicine or something. And just recently they pulled Tom Hart, or he actually kind of just changed time slots. So rather than replace Tom Hartman, I'm sorry, yes. And rather than replace him with a progressive host, they're putting in some financial guy. And rather than replace another progressive host that recently, I don't know why they got rid of, I can't even remember who it was, they put in somebody who talks about consumer issues. And then they have another host that was replaced with a local L.A., you know, concentrating on local L.A. issues, local Los Angeles issues, instead of the broader scope. And I don't even know if they're progressive. I listened a couple of times and I was bored stiff. So I wrote to them. They gave me pretty much a non-answer. Gee, we're sorry you're disappointed, but here's what happened. Tom left and we decided to go with these people, and we can't put replays of Tom in because we've committed to these new people, which wasn't an answer to what I asked.
That's also kind of circular logic. We can't do this because we did that because we did this.
Exactly. But it's just bothering me that, you know, thank goodness for 1480 in D.C., We Act Radio. Thank goodness for the stations that are actually trying to stay progressive. I'm really worried that this one is going to be chipping and chipping away. And we,
you know, and on that, I have to leave you. So I demand you come back with something more fun next week.
Okay.
That's gotta laugh. You can find her work at thepoliticalcarnival.net. We will link to all of these stories on our website, indeepradio.com. I'm Angie Coiro. This is In Deep. This is In Deep. I'm Angie Coiro. We're spending our hour in the workplace, which is funny because most of you are listening to us on a weekend. We do record this on a work day on Thursday. And for some people, it's another day of going to the warehouse and picking up the items that you are saving money on by buying at discount warehouse online sites. And they have to go find those things and scan those things and pack those things. And they are under immense pressure to do it quickly because there is another packet of things that they have to find and scan and send on their way just as fast. True confessions, I use Amazon. I shop through Amazon. I'm like everyone else. I have to count my pennies. It wasn't really until I read this article in Mother Jones magazine written by Mac McClellan that I really thought about what it means to order from a discount site like that. Who are the people on the other side of that transaction? What are they going through to move quickly enough and efficiently enough and under enough duress that I'm saving a couple more bucks? Mac McClellan put a brilliant, brilliant picture together on that for Mother Jones magazine. Her article is, "I was a warehouse wage slave. My brief, backbreaking, rage-inducing, low-paying, dildo-packing time inside the online shipping machine." Mac, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Congratulations on a fantastic title.
Well, thank you. I didn't write, you know, of course the editors do that, so I can't take any credit.
Well, it was bestowed upon an equally excellent article, and I want to go right into that. First, can I ask first why you went to the store to apply, or you went to the service to apply, and you didn't gin up anything for your resume? You were honest about your name and your work history. With that much security behind the work that you've done, why are you calling it Amalgamated Product Giant Shipping Worldwide? Why are you not just revealing the name of who you worked for?
At the suggestion of our lawyers, actually, in case law history, when a journalist goes to work for a company and doesn't tell them specifically, I am a journalist and I will be writing about this, mm-hmm. if the company sues, courts tend to side with the company, not the journalist. So our lawyers recommended that we leave it out just for lawsuit purposes.
Got it. One of the first things you moved into in the article was someone telling you how to behave. The woman at the local chamber of commerce told you that you were about to tell her you were working at Amalgamated Product. And she said, don't take anything that happens to you there personally. And that's a thread that it runs through the story where there's a depersonalization throughout. Of all things, it threw me into the world of Mad Men. And I think enough of our listeners probably watched that I can talk about the scenes where we see back in the day, women who were secretaries were expected to do their crying in the bathroom. Don't bring it here. And the irony is, of course, that is a depiction of a show of the era we're supposed to be past. And here we see in your article, that era is not past at all.
Yeah, well, it's not just girls who aren't supposed to cry on the warehouse floor. Nobody's allowed to have any feelings or get sick or anything like that there. So, yeah, people of all ages and all genders have to abide by the same rules, which are you know, to do your job as quickly as possible. Try to make your insane productivity numbers. If you don't make your insane productivity numbers and people yell at you, don't break down and don't admit that you can't do it and that you are incapable of moving that fast for 10 and a half hours a day, because there's so many people in line for these low-wage jobs because the economy is so bad that they can just fire you and make somebody else do it.
In fact, I think you really caught the essence of the philosophy there with one of the lines in your article. If a pallet falls on you, you won't be working with us anymore.
Right. That's right.
And, you know, if a pallet falls on me, I don't think my first thought would be whether I'll be working there anymore.
Right. It's not like be careful because it would be terrible if you hurt yourself. It's like be careful because you will be fired if you manage to hurt yourself, and you probably need this job to pay your bills.
There's something ironic in the job that you were being asked to do versus the conditions you were being asked to work in. For example, the idea is to get as much done as efficiently and accurately as possible. But with that in mind, the area that you were being asked to work in wasn't set up with that efficiency in mind. For example, there's a shelf that you had to work around where you were constantly getting zapped with little electric shocks.
I mean, ergonomically, it's a disaster because that is the most cost-efficient way of storing all these goods. I mean, you can imagine, you said, you know, in the intro, you shop at Amazon, right? So If you shop at Amazon, you can imagine that how many items there would be in a warehouse for a place like Amazon or like Walmart or, you know, any major giant retailer like that. I mean, there's millions of items that these places have to have. And so once you, you know, try to fill all the space in this warehouse as best you can, you have to have items on the floor and you have to have items on metal shelving that, given the rest of the electricity in the warehouse, you know, shocks you when you touch it. So you do have to be really, really efficient. Obviously, they don't give you the best tools for that, but that's just because it's the most, it's still efficient, but it's cost efficient for them. It just is done at the cost of, you know, the workers' comfort and ability and sustainability and things like that.
You had an interesting perspective on the people working around you as supervisors. The people had to come to you and tell you how you were doing. And in fact, you got one of the worst, you know, job review comments that you weren't performing up to par, which is inconsistent with your work history. So how are you failing here?
That's right. I mean, I'm an overachiever and a nerd. And so I always do a good job, but if the goals that you have at these places are insane. So if I had to get, say, 1,350 items per day, you know, my scanner, which tells me what items I have to get and where they are located and things like that, tells me how long it should take me to get every single thing. And it's like 20 seconds. You know, I have 20 seconds between items to sort of run around. And I was, you know, I'm in pretty good shape. I'm only 31. And I was moving very, very quickly in order to try to make these goals. But I still could only get as good as like 55%. You know, if I worked there for longer, obviously I would get faster at it. Though, you know, the way that my body would hurt when I got home would be terrible. But people come around to tell you how you're doing. And so they would come around, you know, every couple hours and say to me, you're doing a really bad job.
But at the same time, they understood the pressure you were under. At least as I understood the way you were writing it, these people were torn between the fact that they're human beings. They can see the fact that everyone around them is actively suffering. But they are compelled to say, you're not doing a good job, you need to move faster, or you need to do XYZ more efficiently.
Yeah, I mean, they don't have any choice. I mean, my supervisors were probably paid like a dollar more an hour than I was, if that. They have the same. And in fact, in between the time when they have to go around telling everyone how bad they're doing, they have to fulfill their own goals as well. So, I mean, they're people, just like your people. They're not like evil. They're just, they have no choice but to enforce these corporate policies. And the corporate policies are, you know, certainly cooked up by people who've never tried to do this job before and people who certainly aren't doing that job now. And so everyone's sort of in it together in a miserable solidarity kind of way.
It's funny you mentioned solidarity. I was about to go there. This is the kind of situation that you would think is ripe for a union. In fact, your whole article put me in mind of the movie Norma Rae, of the conditions people were working under, that kind of the beaten down attitude, because this is the work that's available. And you depict that in your article. There are people considerably older than you. There are people who are not as in good physical shape as you. This is the job they have. This is the job that they can get. And you'd think it's ripe for unionization. Why is that not?
Well, partly because a lot of the workers at these places are temporary. And so they cycle through very, very quickly. You know, they fire and hire so many people on a daily basis. And, you know, these people don't have benefits. A lot of these warehouses, you know, by one consultant firm's estimates, these warehouses have like 30, you know, percent of their workers totally temporary. They're temps. So you're actually hired by a temp agency, not by the actual company. So you don't even actually work for that company. So, you know, you don't really have a, you don't know how long your assignment is going to be. So you don't really have a stake in trying to organize. Aside from which, you know, they could just hire somebody else. There's so many people who need jobs. You know, nobody in that warehouse was like, I love this job. This job is great. And it's not just because it's manual labor, and manual labor is hard. There needs to be, you know, manual labor, entry-level jobs in the job market. It's an important part of the economy, for sure. But the treatment and the circumstances at these particular kinds of centers is so bad that nobody wants to work them. And even people who are career warehouse workers, people who've been working in warehouses their entire lives, even they hate it. I mean, I worked in a warehouse for 5 years when I was younger, and this was so much worse. But so many other people need jobs that it's not really, I mean, you can't really threaten to leave, right? Mm-hmm. You can't demand better conditions because you could all just be instantly replaced.
Right. A cog can't complain, basically. And in fact, you go into the idea of how these companies are protected, because when Walmart, as you explained in your article, when temps working at a Walmart warehouse sued for not getting paid for all their hours, then getting sent home without pay for complaining, Walmart, because it was technically not their employer, wasn't named as a defendant. So it does keep their hands relatively clean. Did you get a sense for the longest lasting people? What's the longest somebody lasted this kind of thing?
Some people do it for years, and I did another interview, you know, where someone who worked at one of these warehouses called in, and he said, I'm in my 50s, his late 50s, I think he was. He and his wife both worked, I think it was for Amazon, and she had the same kind of job that I had at this warehouse, and the guy was saying, you know, we do this all the time. We do this full time. And then the host asked him, well, how long do you think you can do that for? And he said, probably just a couple of years before your body shuts down. Mm. So it's more like, even if you can suck it up, you know, and you're like, okay, well, this is my job and I'm going to be treated like this. And that's just the way it's going to be. Your body can only take so much. You know, I got an email from a girl after this article came out who used to work for Amazon. She doesn't anymore. She, you know, got a job at a nonprofit or something. She had the same picking job where she had to fulfill orders. And she said that, you know, she worked there for a couple years and she quit, and she still has this grinding noise in her shoulder every time she moves it. And she's 22 years old.
Oh, God. Do you still shop at the warehouse websites?
I'm trying to think if I have bought anything. Certainly I used to. I mean, I don't do a lot of shopping in general, but it has definitely impacted the choices that I make and has sort of like ruined my friends' shopping lives. You know, they're all like, oh, God, I just want to buy something on Amazon, but I can't because now I feel guilty because of you. So it's a little bit infectious, I think.
Mac McClellan, thank you so much for your time.
It's my pleasure.
Mac's article, I Was a Warehouse Wage Slave, is at motherjones.com. We're also linking it from our website, indeepradio.com. I'm Angie Cuero, and this is In Deep.
Found seems too much like work. Work, work. what you're talking about.
Word, word, word.
Are you talking to me?
Word, word, word.
Mm-mm.
Word, word, word.
Hey, 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 hey. Does anybody here know somebody who needs somebody who wants somebody to love?
Love, love.
Now you're talking now.
Love.
I need a little spending change every now and then. I ain't seen a quarter since who knows when. I asked my friends if they could spare a little cash, but all they ever do is stand around and talk trash about the
word, word, word.
What you're talking about?
Word, word, word.
Are you talking to me?
Welcome back to In Deep. I'm Angie Caro. We're spending this hour in the workplace. Mac McClelland from Mother Jones just spent some time with us telling us about what it was like to be a staffer and a stocker and a picker and a packager at a large amalgamated super warehouse that you couldn't identify by name. So you have an idea of what things can be physically in the workplace when you're a cog in the wheel. Well, it turns out that with the marketplace we're in today, with the environment that we have in the economy, going out for a job may make you compromise some things you don't want to. Just in the news this past week, and something the ACLU has already addressed, is the fact that some employers are starting to ask for your Facebook password. Facebook has gotten so far into our society, it's become such a reality for so many people with their life, their affiliations, their opinions, perhaps some political inclinations, all on their Facebook, that employers are starting to plow through that to see what they can find out about you and whether you're a good fit for their office. One of the cases that was cited in the news was a gentleman who had just returned to his job after a death in the family. He was already an employee, and he was asked to provide his Facebook password so he could have his re-entry into the company. And as he told the Associated Press, he needed to eat. He needed to have money to feed his family. And so, as uncomfortable as he was, he passed over his password to Facebook. There's already been some kickback on this, to the point that companies are saying, okay, we won't ask for your password. What we'll do instead is we'll ask you to friend our HR. Either way, they're getting into your Facebook and seeing what you're about and who you hang with. That's the issue here that we're bringing up with Mike Godwin. You might recognize his name from the famous Godwin's Law. If you missed that, we ain't got time to go into it. We'll put it on our website at indeepradio.com. You can look that up there. More to the point, though, he knows a great deal about internet law, especially the intersection of internet and free speech. Mike, thank you for making time for us.
Oh, I'm glad to be here, Angie.
Well, let's talk about the way that technology, once again, as much of a cliche as it is, we should acknowledge that technology and the use of it so often outpace the laws around it. The ACLU is pushing for an internet privacy law. That's not going to help the people who go in for a job tomorrow and are asked to hand over a password. Had you encountered something like this before in the work that you've done?
Well, you know, not personally so far, but I will say that this has actually been a gradually growing issue over time, because initially when we got internet technology in our lives, you know, maybe 20 or 25 years ago, depending on how you count, people were used to using the internet for things like email, and we only gradually began as a culture to recognize that we were, in effect, on some level, broadcasters, that we were making large aspects of our private communications and our personal lives and our social lives much more public than perhaps we ever intended them to be. So even before the World Wide Web, you know, there were internet communications and Usenet news groups that were not just one-to-one email, but one-to-many, like publishing or broadcasting. And people often found that the stuff that they posted socially came back to haunt them in the workplace, where people would be confronted by, you know, their private musings on censorship or, you know, particular personal habits or their own lifestyle choices that somehow were read by employers. So this is a problem that has been with us for a while, But I think it's safe to say, and I think that we all feel, that we're in the process of discovering how platforms like Facebook and Twitter, which give us an immense reach as individuals to communicate our opinions and personalities to the world, are actually posing some risks for us, because either employers or potential employers accidentally come across things that we've said or done, or because employers, maybe because they're concerned about their own public image, maybe for less savory reasons, want to know as much about us as they can find out. And it turns out in the United States, in particular in the United States, this is not quite so true in some other developed countries, but in the United States, we don't have really a shared or consensus legal privacy understanding. And I think that's where the ACLU is coming from. They would like to see a kind of a large scale set of personal privacy expectations enacted into law, much the way we have free speech protections enacted into law.
You've spent a long time as an attorney in these issues. You were the first staff counsel for the Electronic Frontier Foundation. You've seen the evolution of the technology that helps us protect ourselves online. A lot of that is password-based. What are the legal assumptions behind having a password? If I have an account on Facebook and I've made sure that only my friends can see me, if I'm on Twitter and I lock my account so only a selected group of people can see my tweets, does that have any legal weight?
Well, yes and no. I mean, certainly, I think it would depend on the particular case. Certainly, if you have limited who can follow you on Twitter, or if you've limited your circle of friends, or those who can, you know, or if you've created sort of an inner circle of friends on Facebook or in other social media, you could argue legally that you have a kind of expectation of privacy regarding other people snooping into your personal life, including employers or potential employers. But the flip side of that is that you get to waive those rights, whatever the legal rights you may have. And some of this law is unsettled, although it's developing. Whatever the legal rights you have, you may be asked to waive your privacy rights in order to get a job or keep a job.
In that case, then, if you're sitting before someone who is, you know, who has that level of power over you, apparently in the moment, you really don't have that much of a way to defend yourself. Of course, they hold the power. They have the ability to say, fine, you don't get the job. Have there been cases in the past where people who already have jobs, where their internet life has come to the fore and has become some sort of case law?
Well, I'm not going to provide you particular cases because I can give you some general cases that I know have happened, some categories of cases, but I don't have citations for you just on the spur of the moment. But what I'll tell you at the outset is that we're generally familiar with people having discovered, you know, after the fact that something that they thought was private turns out to have been reviewed either by an employer or a friend or, you know, I think the worst cases are spouses, right, where they discover you're signed up to a dating service. You know, we've had those kinds of cases, and it's not primarily, I think once again, it's not primarily that the legal protections aren't there. I think the legal protections are certainly there for people violating your privacy. So if someone hacks into your account, you know, whatever, or does something without your permission, they're generally legally blocked from doing that, or there has to be a particular legal process in place before they can do that. Before they can do that legally, I think that the real issue here is that whatever the legal protections are at the bottom, you're never at the bottom. You're always at some level where you're being asked or required or feel immense amount of pressure to turn over access to your private information.
I want to give the people who are listening to us a bit of a grasp of all the different work you've done so they understand the nature of the questions I'm comfortable asking you about a lot, because you've done so much. In addition to the credentials I've already cited, Mike Godwin has worked as staff attorney and legal director of Public Knowledge, That's a non-governmental organization based in Washington, D.C., and there he focused on intellectual property law. You also have a book that relates your earlier work on cyber rights. It's called Cyber Rights, Defending Free Speech in the Digital Age, and you were one of the lawyers for the Electronic Frontier Foundation who challenged the Communications Decency Act in 1996. With all of this work and with the rest of the work, I don't have time to go through the roster, but I'm assuming that you have developed your own opinion of how secure one ought to feel, whether we're talking about the legality, whether we're talking about ease of password. Is it still true that if you don't want it on the front page of the New York Times, you better not put it on the internet? Is that still a good rule of thumb?
You know, I'm going to give you an unlawyerly answer. I'm going to make it really short. Yes, it's still true. It absolutely is true, and it's something that I try to be continually aware of because I'm online a lot and I engage in different social media and I have a pretty long history of being online, and I think through a lot about what it means to have, you know, more than 20 years of public communications, even stuff that was personal or even stuff that, you know, expressed my personal opinions about political issues or anything else published online. And a lot of that stuff is out there. And so maybe more than people who've gotten online more recently, my past follows me around. And the thing that I've learned is whenever I think something has been totally forgotten, it almost certainly has been remembered by someone and is findable through the miracles of today's search engines. So yes, you should always treat anything you publish, anything that you share, even on a limited circle of friends and on a mailing list or on Facebook or on a limited Twitter following group, any of those things is potentially republishable, potentially leaked out to the public sphere, and you have to be careful about it. I think that is one thing that technology has really fundamentally changed for us, because in the days before mass communications, before the internet, before even, you know, before television, the way you had something, the way you communicated privately to someone would be just to step aside with them, walk away from the crowd, and anything that you said to that person, at least you knew that it was you and that person, and there was no way that your exact words or private thoughts, you know, would be reproduced or would be shared. I mean, there might be gossip, but it was a pretty low-tech way for your private information to leak out. Nowadays, even if you have essentially written to yourself, you know, as people often do on their blogs, you may find that your blog is unexpectedly read by the whole world because you've said something that someone else finds interesting or naughty or intriguing, and they'll recirculate it, and suddenly you're broadcasting the whole world. So much more now, you have to be very aware that anything that you publish externally to yourself is potentially republishable to the world.
You know, I'm going to take advantage of the fact that you're allowing me to probe into your non-lawyerly side for a minute, but putting aside your degrees and putting aside your resume, just talking to you as a denizen of the internet, you and I are roughly the same age, and I think we grew up in an age where there could be a very discreet difference between who you were at work and who you were at a poker game with your friends. And the sense that I'm getting, and part of what we're seeing with this, the workplace examination of who you are online, is that that separation of identities is blurring more and more. And I wonder if, you know, 10, 15 years from now, the person doing the interviewing and the person going for the job both have grown up in a world where there's less of a fence between the two, and that might affect how important it is whether they can access your Facebook page or not. Maybe some of those barriers will have disappeared by then anyway.
Well, I think it's possible that there's going to be a kind of a progressive blurring of the public and private dimensions of our lives, and I've certainly felt it in my own life. You know, I think I try to manage my expectations and fears and accordingly. But I think that there, in some ways, I always look to history and analogous experience, pre-technological experiences in history that may tell us something instructive about what our privacy expectations would be. Many people, I think, for example, 50 or even 100 years ago, assumed that when you moved from a small town into a city, you were losing privacy because you had all these people around you all the time, you know, and you were crowded up against each other in buildings or in apartments, or people would see you eating in public spaces, or they would see you, and so you had less alone time. And so many people thought cities were less private. And in fact, those of us who've had some small town experience know that in kind of a counterintuitive way, living in a small town is hugely non-private.
Oh, it's funny. Matt and I, who both grew up in small towns, we're both nodding here. Yes. Yeah, it's
now,
true.
When you live in a small town, every single thing that you do is interaction with someone else probably gets shared, you know, with other people in your community. So, and there were people who moved to cities and found the relative anonymity and privacy in cities very, very refreshing compared to what they saw as the closeness and oppressiveness of small town environments, which seemed to them to lack much more privacy than cities did. And cities were havens of privacy and considered havens of anonymity. So that made cities in some ways very exciting for people. So I think something may happen similarly with online media. I think as people become more accustomed to creating their identities and creating some privacy zones for themselves, they will actually create pretty effective private spaces. I mean, nothing is going to keep out a truly dedicated intruder or snoop, but you can keep out most people. For example, I'll just give you an example from my personal life, and that's that when my daughter first started blogging, you know, I thought she had interesting things to say. She's a very writerly person. She's now 19 and off at college. But when she was a younger teenager and she blogged, you know, I read her blog from time to time. And then one time I said to her something, I referenced something in her blog, and it hadn't occurred to her before I said it that I could read her blog. Mm-hmm. And what she immediately did is set up all the privacy protections. And I thought, you know, that's appropriate. I'm okay with that. And I think we've struck a really good balance that came from becoming much more aware of what the privacy expectations have been and should be in different media.
Well, I want to ask you one more question before we let you go here, because you brought up this wonderful analogy, the small town versus large town. And I think that some of the idea of privacy that you have in a larger town, you're a smaller piece of the equation. You're not 1/100th of the town. You're 1/1,000,000,000th of the town. This touches into a different issue of internet privacy, and that is, we're all worried about people collating our information. We're sending information out over the internet. Oh my gosh, they're looking at what websites I look at. They're looking at which ads I click on, et cetera. Is that too, in your mind, going to be less of a concern? Because the more people that come online, the longer the generations have been online, it's not, hey, who's Angie Coiro looking at? It's, okay, here is a middle-aged woman of such and such a financial income, and here's how we market to her. Is that going to be less of a concern too?
There are really two aspects of a collection of information that come to the fore as people are looking forward, and they're looking both at government collection of private information and commercial collection of private information. The rules for government collection of private information are largely pretty well, you know, they're not complete, but they're pretty well explored in the United States and other developed countries. With regard to commercial collection, where people are trying to find out what your usage patterns are, what you buy, what you're interested in, some of the large search engines are really taking pains to separate a collection of data from personally identifiable information. So they'll get sort of statistical information based on what you do, but they won't necessarily profile you individually. Other commercial interests are going to try to get you to waive your privacy expectations and volunteer a lot of private information, you know, in order to market stuff to you. And people are going to have to learn how to make intelligent decisions about what kind of commercial relationships they set up.
Mike Godwin, you're an absolute gem. Thank you so much for all this information.
Glad to be here, Angie.
And we're going to put some link up to Mike's information at indeepradio.com. I'm Angie Coiro. You're listening to In Deep.
Thank you. gamble. We don't do the stock exchange. We paint paintings. We write scenes for the stage. We will talk about welfare. We will talk about sex. Talk about the Pope and Prada shoes. Nobody gets upset. Nobody gets upset. And we're waiting. We're waiting for your call. We're against privacy. We're against privacy.
This is In Deep. I'm Angie Kerr. So we have been talking this hour about workplace situations, Mac McClelland with her dismal experience in a warehouse fulfillment job. And we've talked, too, about the Facebook issue where employers are asking people for their Facebook passwords to check out their personal life, check out their wall, perhaps even their friends. And as some of them have stated, check if you have gang affiliations. And it might be clear to some of you now that in many situations, the employer holds many, many cards. For example, in the Facebook situation, one of the cases written up by the Associated Press, the gentleman sitting there having his re-interview for a job he had already held before a death in his family was essentially forced to hand over his Facebook password because it was him versus the company. Now, you already know what my particular leanings are. I think everybody's better off with a union in the workplace. And it's one of those situations where if you see the position these folks have been in, Mac in her warehouse and Robert in his job with the Facebook issue, they were sitting there with maybe one or two cards while the company held the rest of the deck. If you've considered in the past, or perhaps you're just getting the glimmer of this now as you're listening to this hour, that a union might be worth looking into for your workplace, we'd like to give you the ABCs of how that is done so you can realistically assess the risks. You'll know what you're getting into. You'll know what the potential benefits are. And to help us out with that, I have on the line Peter Olney. He is the ILWU Organizing Director. And Peter, you're out and about, and I appreciate you taking the time.
Oh, I'm glad to be on your show, Angie. I think you're doing a great public service to the workers of America.
I appreciate that. Well, you know, a lot of the workers of America are not unionized now, and we're seeing more and more of the situations where essentially, the company's just plain call the shots. So let's say you're working in a warehouse, a la Mac McClelland in her earlier story, and you think, you know, maybe I ought to look into unionizing here. What's the first step?
Well, the first step that workers often take, which is a good step, is to take a look at the unions that represent workers in their industries. And sometimes I've had workers, you know, a couple of them get together in the workplace and they call me up and say, we want to talk with you about your union, what you're about, what resources you have to help us organize and what industries you represent so that we can assess whether you have power in our industry. So the first step that workers often take on their own, and which is a good first step, is to contact a union. And maybe you want to talk to a few unions. I've had workers' committees in plants preform and actually interview a bunch of different unions before they actually decide who they want to work with, which is a perfectly legitimate approach on the part of workers. But I would tell workers to call a union, to talk to the organizing director or an organizer, somebody who has had experience with this kind of campaigning and organizing, and ask a lot of questions and see whether you think this union is committed to working with you, and whether this union represents other workers in your industry or in allied industries, because you need to assess whether, you know, they can bring power to bear on your employer to change that horrible equation that workers face on their own.
Yeah, that's really wonderful. I like the picture you're painting there, because I recall when I was younger and I started to organize a union in my workplace, I knew that in my case it was AFTRA, the Federation of Television Radio Actors. And I wasn't in the mindset where I thought, okay, I have the power to shop around and go talk to people. Fortunately, I was in the hands of a marvelous union. But I like the idea that you're painting there, that you are already starting from a position of power. You can go out and talk to unions and see what's best for you. You're not going begging.
No, you shouldn't go begging, and you should talk to a lot of different unions if you can. I mean, there's some. Obviously, if you're a radio announcer, you don't have too many choices. The ILWU is not your fit, nor is the Steelworkers Union. But, you know, you want a union that has some expertise in the industry you're working in and experience. But sometimes in the case of warehousing, there's multiple unions that represent warehouse workers.
One of the situations we heard from Mac McClellan was she was working, and because of legal considerations, although she went to this company and was reporting firsthand, she had to call it, you know, Amalgamated Huge Warehouse, because she legally couldn't disclose which company she was with. It sounded like an Amazon or maybe a Walmart. But the way they stepped around the union issue is, although she showed up there at their warehouse with their equipment on their hours, she was technically an employee of a hiring firm, a secondary body, so that, you know, Amalgamated, whatever company that actually was, could say, well, you know, she's really not our employee. How are the unions working to get around that?
Well, we're having a lot of discussions about that issue. It's a huge issue in certain industries. It's not the predominant mode of employment, although in certain kinds of warehouses it is. There's two issues. One is we're moving on the legislative front to try to restrict the use of temps. There's actually going to be legislation here in the state of California that will significantly, I think, reduce the use of temps in certain industries, because it does create not just obstacles to organizing, but obstacles to, you know, decent wages and conditions and to fairness on the job. And the second thing is that even if people work for temp agencies, the fundamental question of organizing is one of power and support. And if workers come together, are willing to risk a lot to step out and confront their employer, whether they're temps or whether they're statutory employees, there's a lot that can be done, particularly if the union itself has linkages, like they say they represent the truck drivers who delivered to that warehouse. That gives that union considerable power over what happens with those employees. In fact, the Teamsters Union, before there was a labor law that had gave any kind of protections to people, succeeded in organizing a lot of warehousing based on the fact that they controlled the flow of goods by having truck drivers in unions.
I'm talking about union organizing with Peter Olney. He's with the ILWU as their organizing director. That's the International Longshore and Warehouse Union. So let's take this chronologically. We have someone who's become interested in a union. They have looked at their available unions, and they've contacted the one they're interested in. As I understand it, my information is a bit dated here, Peter, so you can bring me up to date. As I understand it, once you start talking to a union, there are certain protections that kick in, so that if a company finds out you're organizing, you are protected. They can't just say, hey, you're not allowed to organize here, go home.
Well, there are protections, but there aren't protections. In other words, yes, the law says that you cannot be fired or discriminated against because of your willingness to form unions or act together with other employees, but employers rarely make the mistake of hiring somebody and overtly stating the cause of discharge's involvement with the union. They'll mm-hmm. find something as an excuse and discharge somebody. So it's not an easy thing to do, and it's something you got to be very careful about. So that's why talking to an experienced organizer is very important. And an experienced organizer, if you approach them from, say, a warehouse, will say to you, don't be talking union in your workplace. until we're able to put together a committee and map out the workplace. So what I tell workers when they call me is, don't be going out on the floor of the warehouse and talking union. Be quiet about the union. Yeah, listen to people, identify people who have grievances and problems, but don't be talking union right now. We have a lot of prep work to do with you and a few other workers who want to do this, and then we'll start talking union. So, you know, it's a human thing when you're onto something good and you see change coming to want to share it with other workers. So what I tell them is somewhat counterintuitive, but they need to know that. It's like, I hate to use a military analogy, but it's like if you gave somebody a gun and said, go out on the battlefield, and they never went through boot camp, you know what would happen to them.
Right. So there are protections. Just don't be naive about it.
There are protections, but don't be naive, and we'll use those protections later on. Right now, we've got some work to do. We got to map out your workplace. Works there. Every worker in the to be try to get their phone numbers, figure out who their supervisors are, what are their issues, what shift are they, how many years have they worked there. We went through a laundry survey of the workplace first, and we mapped the whole place, including a physical map that we put up on a wall, and then we build a database of everybody in the place so that we have an understanding of who's working there and what the issues are. And at that point, then we might start to say, you know, we need a bigger group. We need a bigger group of employees here to get the job done. So let's go out and talk to some other people.
Oh, when you're trying to expand it, one of the things that has always stymied me, our educational system doesn't talk anymore about the history of unions, about the benefit of unions, or even, to be fair, even whatever downsides there might be to unions. Our educational system doesn't talk about unions at all. So when you go to organize a workplace, you're dealing with people who have whatever conceptions and misconceptions that may have come through their family, or they've picked up in the media, they've heard on a talk show, but you're really not talking in most cases to people who understand the ins and outs of unionizations, the pros, the cons, the benefits, and how it's done. How do you go about educating a workplace full of people so they can make an informed choice?
Well, there's a certain amount of teaching and talking that goes on, but, you know, the real way to show people the union difference is to have other workers who are in a union talk to them about the difference on the job. So if you have a warehouse worker who's been in a union, they can come and talk about what it means in terms of dealing with speed up or dealing with the heat in a warehouse in 100 degrees in the summer in the desert. You know, all those issues that drive workers to organize can be addressed by other workers who are working under a union contract. But the real teaching about unionism comes through action. And the only way to do that is for the workers themselves, and even in the non-union workplace, to take action. So we like the workers, even when they don't have a union, to learn to exercise their power. So if they have an issue on the job or somebody gets unfairly disciplined, we like workers to be able to, you know, stop work and protest those conditions, which the law also gives you the right to do. And that kind of activity is very protected. And it's very powerful. As opposed to one person doing something on their own, the concept of union or people acting in unity or together is what we always stress.
I think that's one of the things that those who work against unions have tried to capitalize when you talk about rights. There's this presentation of the right to work. Nothing sounds more intuitively correct and appropriate than the right to work. And of course, that's not really what the right to work is at all. For those who've heard the phrase and don't understand it, if you hear a company pushing for the right to work or a legislation pushing for the right to work, what are they getting at there?
Well, what the company's getting at is basically the right to work for nothing, or the right to shirk your duties to support the organization that binds you together with your fellow employees and helps to achieve better wages and conditions for you. What right to work legislation does is makes it illegal for it to be a term and condition of employment, to be a mandatory union membership. So what that means is in right to work states, you don't have to be part of the union, even though you're benefiting from the wages and conditions that the union has negotiated. So that means that, you know, people opt out and don't become part of the union. The union's weakened. It doesn't have resources to represent people. The union is not strong, and the employer takes advantage of that, and the whole employer class takes advantage of that. So you look in the right to work states in this country, of which there are now 23 after Indiana became a right to work state. You'll see that on average, the wages and benefits are far lower than in the states that do not have right to work.
Peter Olney's on the line from the ILWU. We're talking about how to unionize your workplace and what that entails. We just interviewed last week Tracy McMillan, who wrote a book about the American way of eating. And as part of her work, she went to work in the fields picking food. She went to places where food is sold. She worked in a grocery store. One of the things that she found out in the Walmarts of the world is that the people who work there, who may or may not understand the concept of union, are relieved not to have one in a number of cases, because as far as they're concerned, their checkbook is bigger, their check is bigger because they're not paying into a union. It strikes me that one of the challenges to help people understand why there is a net gain to a union if there's going to be less in your paycheck.
Yeah, well, I mean, two comments on that. One, if what we tell workers is, when we organize, that, look, we're going to fight together with you and work together with you to achieve the things that you want to do in this workplace. And one of those will be a raise. And if that raise eclipses the cost of membership and you don't see a sum total gain in terms of your paycheck, then the battle isn't over, and you don't want to settle for that. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that whole perspective is a lot inculcated in people because people are taught to see the union as a third party, like an insurance agency. So who would go to an insurance if they didn't, you know, deliver the goods for you? Mm-hmm. So the idea, what you need people to understand is that you pay dues to an organization that's yours. I mean, people think nothing of going to the VFW or the Kiwanis Club or a softball club and paying dues as the cost of supporting the activity. Well, the same understanding needs to be developed around unions, that it's not a third party. It's your baby. You've got to pay for it.
I've really put you up against the clock on this one, and I hope you can answer it in shorthand to some extent. But we're hearing battles across the country about a card check for the union. And what is the status right now of companies being able to keep the voting open, keep the voting, to allow a union to be voted on? What's happening with that?
Well, the traditional approach to unionization was that if you got 30% or more of the workers in a particular workplace on a representation card, then you could have a federally supervised election, and the workers would vote yes or no, and 50% plus one of the employees voted for the union, then the union was in. Problem with that, and that sounds wonderful. It sounds like Athens, true democracy. The problem is that the employer has all kinds of weapons at their disposal to subvert that vote. They can have captive audience meetings with workers. They can threaten and fire people. They can delay the election. So unions of late have turned to card check, whereby if you get 50% plus one of the workers in a particular workplace to sign a card saying they want to be union, the union has to be recognized by the employer, and the employer has to sit down and bargain a contract. That was federal legislation called the Employee Free Choice Act. It was introduced 4 years ago in Congress, and there was great hope that Obama would, move it when he came into office. That didn't happen. So that legislation is presently dead, obviously, with a Republican House.
Yeah. Well, you managed to fit that in shorthand just beautifully, and I really appreciate your taking the time. I'm sure this is going to be valuable to so many people.
Yeah, I look forward to talking to you again. I think it's great that you did this show. I really like the focus and the thinking behind it, so call me again if we need to chat.
You got a deal. That's Peter Olney with the ILWU. We'll put a link to his organization at our website at indeepradio.com. And that's a wrap for this week. You can follow us on Twitter at InDeep Radio or on Facebook as InDeep with Angie Cordero. Our executive producer is Gordon Whiting. Matt Fidler is our engineer. Our theme is by Big Troubles. David Gans provides our closing music. I'm Angie Cordero. You're listening to InDeep. We'll take our culture back someday. Thanks for tuning in this week to InDeep, which is a production of Live from the Left Coast. You can get more information on the show and our company at lftlc.com. Live from the Left Coast, while you're there, you can become a member and support our work. We have a separate website for the show that is indeep.org. If you have any questions or feedback, there's a contact button right there, indeep.org. We are developing a recurring series on mental health issues in our country, especially in this economy, and you're a big part of that. We'd like your topic suggestions, your stories, and your questions. Send them in via our website, the contact button at indeep.org. Join us again this time next week for two more hours of in-depth conversation. I'm Angie Cuero. Thanks, and we will see you then. You are listening to WPWC, 1480 AM, Dumfries, Virginia. We Act Radio, home of Washington's progressive working community.